Okay. All right. Thank you, everybody, for your patience with my tech illiteracy. Okay. So I'm going to talk today just about how I work with LEANs, and I want to acknowledge up front that there are a number of you here who are already working with LEANs and probably working differently. And there's lots of different ways of working with LEANs, but today I'm just going to present how I
work. Excuse me, Karen, I can hardly hear you.
Ah.
I'm not sure about the others.
How faint. Is that better?
It's a bit better, but yes, we'll have to turn volumes up at our end and have you shouting down into your microphone. That'd be great.
I do have my volume on high, so just hoi me in the middle of the presentation if I get low. Okay. Oh, God.
It's just about being close to your microphone.
Yep, I am. I'm sitting on it.
Good.
Okay, so basically just to understand some of the decisions that I have to make, I will cover some of the aspects of LEANs because it is so different from a lot of the other neurotherapies out there. So one of the things is that LEANs mirrors back to the CNS its own activity. So in terms of dominant frequency with the addition of an offset. So an offset is a number which, when added to the dominant frequency, determines the feedback frequency. And the offset was devised as a way to increase or decrease the pull on the physiology or the strength of the treatment. So those numbers range from minus 100 to positive 100. The dominant frequency calculations themselves interrupt the maladaptive patterns that the brain has acquired in response to bumps on the head or physical emotional trauma. Genetic factors, environmental influences, anoxic events, chemotherapy treatment, and so on. The feedback and any baseline or non-feedback period make up the LEAN signal that's sent via the senses to the scalp. So it's a sensory rather than a tactile rather than a visual feedback. The lens itself detects the dominant brainwave pattern, which is often dysfunctional. It disrupts this dominant pattern with a well-timed lens signal to the scalp. And then the lens signal, it causes a rebalancing, and you can see the amplitudes change and a new dominant frequency forms that's less stuck and more flexible. If I just have a look at the top one, on the spectrum display, sometimes you'll see the dominant frequency getting stuck in around about 2 to 5, not moving very much. This white bar shows where it is at the moment. And you don't see very much movement there at all. But after delivering the feedback, you'll often see this bar increase in amplitude and you'll see it move more freely across the spectrum. The kind assessment is much like any other assessment in terms of initial intake. So I won't go through that, but then the lens assessment determines our protocol. So we have an assessment for sensitivity. So we're asking what is the smallest amount of information required for the brain to notice. So it might be, you know, that person who says that they feel a change in the weather coming in their knees. So they would be, you know, quite sensitive. Reactivity is how strong their reaction to the stimulus or information that they feel. There's sort of like a spectrum or two types of that reactivity. There's, you know, a reactive and then a severe reactive. What Len Oakes himself sort of deems as being on a seizure spectrum, somebody who has a history of headaches, cluster headaches, migraines, seizures, tics, Tourette's, stuttering, explosive behaviours, severely reactive. And the degree of reactivity determines two things. It determines the duration of the application of the feedback and the degree of disruptiveness that we select. Resilience is person's hardiness, how fast do they recover from things like colds, flu, or strep throat. And in terms of neurofeedback, if you just over-treat them a little bit, are they the type to go to their bed and pull the doona up for the next month? Or are they the type that just sort of soldier on and come back anyway? developing an initial treatment plan. The dose is determined by, is the number of sites that we visit in each session, and it's determined by the sensitivity. And we always start with an initial, you know, toe in the water approach. That little image there of the sensitive and reactive, that's the standard one that we use when we're teaching LENS. I have a scale that's a little bit more sensitive, and it determines degrees of sensitivity and reactivity, but still fits within that. So somebody who's very sensitive and very reactive, we might only do one or two sites initially. Somebody who's not very sensitive and not reactive, we could do 6 to 12 sites in the first session. The duty cycle refers to whether we pulse or deliver a continuous feedback, and that's determined by their reactivity or irritability. So 1% duty cycle refers to 1% of a second, so 1/100th, and is delivered each second, whereas 100% duty cycle would be a continuous over the whole second. A seizure spectrum, person on a seizure spectrum is highly reactive. They would always have 100% duty cycle, whereas everybody else tends to be treated with a 1% duty cycle. So that's a part of that decision-making matrix that I have to adhere to. The offset is determined by a person's resiliency and how much pull their physiology can tolerate. So high offsets, something in, 98, 100, would be a very weak pull on their physiology, whereas lows offsets, 2, 3, 5, that's a very strong pull on their physiology. The length of period or the duration of the feedback is determined by the client's response, and the usual starting protocol is about 1 to 2 seconds. A little bit more about reactivity. The client has been highly reactive. We take a lot more conservative approach with the first several sessions. We keep applications under 10 seconds in duration, and we avoid disruptive applications. Once a person's had, a number of about 5 to 7 sessions, you notice their reactivity is much less. So then you can actually adjust the duration and the disruptiveness of it. So customised protocols then to make something more disruptive, a one-channel application is far more disruptive than a two-channel. We can use a non-homologous site choice of the two-channel instead of a homologous site. We can introduce the use of a baseline. So instead of running an application for 4 seconds, we might run it for 2 seconds, have a 2 second break and another 2 seconds. We can introduce positive or negative variable protocol, and that's utilising the offset numbers. And then we have the choice, which I very rarely move away from. Broad carrier band is the default. Occasionally, if you wanted a really strong protocol, you might move to a narrow carrier band. But that tends to be contraindicated with anybody with anxiety. The CNS form, this is quite important. We're looking at activation and anxiety in clients, because what we found is that in the questionnaire, anybody that answers 3 or more out of 10 to some of the answers, their level of anxiety is going to influence their response to LENS. And if we over-treat an anxious person, the feedback is more likely to just be ignored. And so you make very little progress. So we, after creating an initial protocol, we start collecting data at 21 sites. So we utilise the site of OZ and FEZ as well. And we may gather that data over one or many sessions, depending on the client tolerance. The only real difference between when we talk about a map and a site sort, which is the treatment phase of it, the only difference is the name. the data for the maps is collected in any order, but once the data is collected, it tends to be sorted into a sequence for treatment. But the protocols don't change very much. The lens maps are a standard map, displays topographic information as well as bar graphs of site averages of amplitude and dominant frequency, as well as standard deviation. The average amplitude information is also displayed for the subbands, delta, theta, and so forth. Suppression maps were introduced a few years ago. They display the average coefficient of variation at each site. So it's the amplitude divided by the standard deviation. The bar graphs for each of these maps are arranged in different sequences. And in the average amplitude and standard deviation map, the bars are positioned in order from the least sum of amplitude or dominant frequency in standard deviation to the greatest sum. This arrangement is then called a site sort, and it guides the practitioner in the order of treatment. There's limitations for lens maps, quite severe when viewed from the point of view of the standard neurofeedback or QEEG practice. There's no normative database used, and the sites are not monitored simultaneously, which prevents direct measurement of coherence and phase. And also the data is not artifacted, and relatively little time is spent recording the data each site, thinking that we're only using sometimes 1 or 2 seconds. 2 seconds we need to get sufficient data. It's measuring 256 times per second, and it's being averaged 16 times a second. Whereas, you know, most of your, when you're collecting data, you're doing it for 3 minutes or more. This is what a total amplitude map looks like. The mean total amplitude is arranged in order from the lowest amplitude down here at T3 through to O1. And we tend to follow that, that sequence in treating. Of particular importance is the standard deviation. So this is the light blue at the top of each bar. It shows how flexible this data is. I'll just go on to the next. The program will rearrange it into a suppression map. So the EEG suppression, or what we regard as suppression, is where standard deviation falls below 35% of the site's amplitude. Lens says that while high amplitudes are said to be the cause for concern and typical of the EEG slowing, where higher power moves into slower EEG waves and are common to most pathology. When suppression lifts, in nearly every case, functioning noticeably increases in all areas. So this is an example of a suppression map. Sorry, clicking around. This gentleman is actually, you can see here, if 35% up here is the norm, or what they deem to be the norm, then this gentleman is quite stressed. And certainly here on the dominant frequency, so stressed, it's not even showing on the graph at all. This gentleman was actually homicidal. He was quite explosive. The maps are useful guides for the treatment order of decision making, but they're not report cards for the client. So it always comes back to, even if there are improvements on looking at the maps, it always comes back to how does the client feel. I just want to share a couple of case studies with you, just to give an indication of how I work with them. Jan is a 69-year-old female. She was divorced for many years, living alone, but providing childcare support 2 days and 2 nights a week for her son during his access visits. He had a child aged 3. Her son has alcohol abuse, very, very impulsive and very reactive, bordering on a bit abusive towards her. She presented to me with low mood, anger, uncontrolled tearfulness, increased irritability and intolerance with her son's behaviour and beginning to become irritable with the grandchild. She reported crying uncontrollably with very little provocation. General history of well-being. She meditated, she was a Reiki practitioner, had a healthy lifestyle, but she was becoming very isolated and not motivated to socialise. She was reluctant to take medication. Her GP wanted her to go on SSRIs. There was no history of allergies, heavy metals or any other, a little bit of emotional abuse in a former marriage. Her goal was to be less reactive to her son's behaviour and not as irritable. To find the motivation to be able to reconnect with her friends and not be quite so tearful. She was very embarrassed about the degree of her tearfulness. Looking at her sensitivity, it was quite low. She was quite reactive, but not in the explosive range. And she was very highly resilient. So the first session was a two-channel homologous. Doing the maps, I tend to start, everybody has a different idea, so, and I'm very aware of that. Some people like to start gathering data and they may, I think Corey Hammond likes to start on the left-hand side. Other people feel, because they're incorporating some of their other theories of neurofeedback into that, prefer to go to the right side first. Other people, like myself, I start with homologous thoughts. I might start with an FP1, FP2 and work my way back towards the back of the head and then come forward and work back again. It doesn't really matter. Six sites is sort of my toe in the water when somebody's not, when the below sensitivity. A 1% duty side of call with her, only because she's not highly, highly reactive. And the offset default is usually 20. And I stayed with that because she's quite resilient and is a good reporter. Her response in the first 24 to 48 hours was relaxed, calmer after the session. And she'd noticed that she was less reactive initially in the first 24 hours, but the effects wore off after 2 days. And that's quite common with means, as we sort of find that the effects start, they'll report, a couple of days, then it'll be 4 days, 5 days, 7 days. Once they get to 7 days, they tend to move them out to fortnightly sessions. So she was fairly consistent. We have a look at her total amplitude maps. This is the top one, was her initial one. And so I followed that site sort, choosing 2, 3, 2, 4. And moving my way across. At the end of it, I don't see a great significant difference in the amplitude. But what you'll see below here is a more uniform standard deviation. And even though it wasn't 35% in all of them, she noticed a significant difference. So this is her suppression maps, and I work a lot with suppression maps. It's just my choice. You can work with the standard or you can work with the suppression. And I think most of my clients that come in have significant suppression, so that was the reason for my choices there. You can see here that even in a first map, she had some that were sort of within the normal range, but there was some very low, highly suppressed sites. At the end, you sort of question, some of them are more suppressed, but it's not highly, 0.35, 35% is about here. But what you do notice is that it's more uniform across, it's not so extreme. And that's one of the things that I'm noticing more and more in the practice over the years, is that if I can get that more uniform, anywhere between about 25%, and 30% standard deviation is usually around that when I'm definitely getting significant improvements. I don't necessarily aim always to get up and beyond the 35%. Again, it comes back to the patient reporting, but I'm not stressing if a client wants to stop here, because they're feeling fantastic. And that was my own experience. You know, I used Lyme's for fibromyalgia. I've had great success with it, but I never ever managed to lift my secretion over 0.28. Her outcome was 15 sessions. The effects were lasting a full week at 9th session. She moved to fortnightly. The effects were lasting 10 days initially and then a full fortnight by the 14th session. She had one follow-up session 1 month later and she was saying that she was utilising all her other strategies then. She was quite motivated. She was no longer tearful. She was presenting as cheerful. She was less reactive to her son's behaviours and able to set some limits with him. And she re-engaged with her friendship groups. This gentleman is quite the opposite. He took a long time to treat. He had, he was a 58-year-old divorced gentleman, estranged from most of his family, living with his mother as carer, and he was angry and hostile. He reported that he'd been depressed since primary school, always wanted to die. He didn't enjoy school. He'd tried multiple antidepressants, ECT, CBT, and other, he just said everything. He saw neurofeedback as a last resort. He was suicidal, but he wasn't going to act on it because his previous suicide attempt, his daughter had found him. But he went to bed every night hoping he died. Wouldn't discuss plans for weekends because he hoped he would die, not have to think about it. Again, with him, low sensitivity, he reported, he wasn't a particularly good reporter, but he was extremely reactive, very explosive, but still very resilient. So again, two-channel homologous, six sites, but with him using the 100% duty cycle. After about 7 to 10 sessions with him, his explosiveness reduced considerably and we were able to move to a 1% duty cycle then. He always reported that he never felt anything, and this was his initial map. These, by the way, were all theta. And this was his follow-up map at the end of 34 sessions it took to treat him. At 3 months, we were noticing the changes. He kept saying he didn't feel any different, but we were noticing when he came into the clinic, he started making eye contact with other staff member and clients. He began talking to others where he refused earlier. His reactivity diminished. At 6 months, he started making jokes, smiling. He still claimed he didn't feel any different. At 7 months, he was making plans to fly interstate to visit formerly estranged brothers and other relatives. And by 8 months, he was making arrangements for weekend activities, taking his daughter out to football on weekends. And then at the 34th session, he conceded that he might have been feeling a little bit better. I think I'm running out of time, so I'm just going to flip through a couple of pre and post maps. There's a standard map again for a child with ADHD. Post, you'll see again the standard deviation lifting. Again, this pattern of high and low, but once it sort of like was more even, significant improvements in her behaviour at school and at home, less impulsive. This child was reactive, attachment disorder, extreme when he first came to see me. Same pattern of improved standard, increased standard deviation. Again, this extreme. This is just what I'm observing over time, is it doesn't necessarily have to be a perfect, 35% standard deviation. I'm finding if I can get this sort of more uniform pattern that it usually I'm getting reports that the client is feeling better or others are noticing changes. So with using the lens, we just use enough of the body to get it and then stop. And the motto is always less is more. Okay.
Wow. Thank you very much, Karen. I'm really impressed by what seems to me, because I do amplitude chanting, but the small, comparatively small number of sessions to see really positive changes.
I think I'm always very cautious with that, Michelle. You know, we do sort of are noticing around about 15 is, you know, when a lot of people stop. And I don't know whether that's just, you know, I don't know. But even in the States, they're saying 15 is the number. But that gentleman, as I said, took 34 sessions. He was long-term chronic. I don't know whether that was the reason or whether perhaps he was one of my earlier clients and maybe I just wasn't as skilled. But certainly, you know, I do get some extremes where I get a couple of sessions right through to, you know, 25. So I'm always cautious when I quote numbers like that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Just another excellent and different presentation. Three very different presentations today, and much appreciated for everybody. Before we move on, and do we have any questions from participants? You'll need to unmute yourself to contribute, please. Can I ask if there's anyone else out there who has experience with lens?
Come on, fess up, I know you are. And very good too.
Everyone's way too shy or they've gone off to make a cup of tea. Karen. That was much appreciated presentation. I had also listed for today Richard Clark, who was going to present for us on